2 years and 2 days after the war in Gaza began, a lasting peace deal may be in sight.
We will have the latest on the plan to release hostages and to pause the airstrikes.
For Thursday, October 9th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Ahead, how researchers are working to influence when cells break down and die and what that means for deadly diseases.
If we can specifically modify or modulate the tendency of a cell to die, then of course we have the potential to treat a cancer.
Also, how Bob Ross's Happy Clouds are helping cash-strapped public television stations.
The latest on the fancy butter that shoppers cannot stop buying.
And a visit to the tech fairy.
I love fixing computers and watching people smile, so it's been really good for me.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. Federal prosecutors have secured an indictment against New York Democratic Attorney General Letitia James. The charges come after President Trump publicly pressured the Justice Department to prosecute James and other vocal critics. She calls the charges baseless and says they are a, quote, desperate weaponization of our justice system. NPR's Ryan Lucas reports.
New York Attorney General Letitia James has been charged with one count of bank fraud and one count of false statements to a financial institution. The indictment was handed up by a federal grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia, secured by the same interim U.S. attorney there who last month brought charges against another prominent Trump critic, former FBI Director James Comey. As the attorney general for New York State, James sued Trump and his company for inflating the value of some of its assets. James won that civil fraud case and a more than $450 million judgment, although an appeals court later tossed the financial penalty. Trump has long lashed out at James and publicly called for retribution, and last month directed Attorney General Pam Bondi to go after James and other perceived political foes. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
The United Nations says it plans to get hundreds of trucks a day into Gaza once the U.S.-brokered peace plan goes into effect. The U.N. Secretary General calls this a glimmer of relief after 2 years of devastating war, as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
In the first phase of the agreement, Israel is to pull back and allow in aid, and Hamas is to release all of the Israeli hostages that remain in Gaza. The U.N.'s top humanitarian official, Tom Fletcher, says the U.N. is ready to deliver once the aid pipeline opens.
Famine must be reverted in areas where it has taken hold and prevented in others.
The U.S. and Israel had been working around the U.N. to deliver food at a few sites in southern Gaza. The new plan puts the U.N. back at the center of humanitarian operations. Secretary General Antonio Guterres says the U.N. has the expertise and the networks inside Gaza to act quickly. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The execution of Texas death row inmate Robert Roberson has been put on hold. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals granted a stay today, 1 week before he was sent to die by lethal injection. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reports.
In a sudden turnaround, Texas's highest criminal court ruled that Roberson's execution should not move forward, but they did not grant him a new trial, which is what his attorneys have been calling for. They argue that the new evidence will show Roberson didn't murder his 2-year-old daughter, Nikki, and that she died from an illness. This is the third execution date that Roberson has faced. He was set to be executed on October 16th. I'm David Martin Davies in San Antonio.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Vice President J.D. Vance is headed to Indiana again tomorrow as the White House continues to push for Republican-led states to redraw their congressional districts to make them more favorable for GOP candidates. Texas and Missouri quickly answered the call to redistrict, but Indiana lawmakers have been more hesitant. Vance's visit is at least the third time he'll be talking to Indiana Republican lawmakers about the possibility. The Trump administration is preparing to release new dietary guidelines for Americans. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports the recommendations could be controversial based on public comments made by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
The guidelines are updated every 5 years, and Secretary Kennedy has said he would like to see streamlined guidance that advises people to eat, quote, whole foods, healthy foods, local foods. A committee of experts that reviewed recent nutrition science concluded that plant-based proteins, including beans, should be emphasized. However, leaders in the Make America Healthy Again movement are making the case for meat and full-fat dairy, which some say have been vilified. Current recommendations emphasize consuming fruits and vegetables, lean meats, legumes, and whole grains, while avoiding too much saturated fat, sugars, and refined carbohydrates. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Tropical storms Priscilla and Raymond in the Pacific Ocean are threatening to bring flooding to the Southwest through the weekend, and a ship parade rolled up the Delaware River in Philadelphia today, kicking off the 250th birthdays of the United States Navy and Marine Corps. Vice Admiral John Gumbleton encouraged civilians to talk to active and retired military members visiting the city and to ask them about their service. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 5:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support comes from Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, presenting Sketches of Minnesota, a civic community comedy tour, on Saturday, October 11th. Doors at 5 p.m., dinner at 6. Open to all, with registration required. Info at edgecenterarts.org. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE, KBXE news team.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Scott Detrow in Washington. Today, Israelis in Tel Aviv celebrated the announcement of a ceasefire deal in the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. Israeli hostages and Palestinian prisoners may start going home within a few days. And after 2 years, the most deadly war ever between Israelis and Palestinians may soon be over. For the latest, we are joined by NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Scott.
A lot of moving parts to this ceasefire deal. What is happening now and what would happen after that?
Yeah, Israel's government is holding a late-night meeting. It's expected to approve the ceasefire deal, and when it does, it will take effect 24 hours after the vote. Now, this also starts the clock ticking for Israel to start pulling back troops, but it will still have about half of Gaza under its control during this first phase. Now, the clock will be ticking for Hamas as well. It needs to get the Israeli hostages ready for release. There are believed to be 20 living hostages, 28 dead hostages. President Trump said today this could happen on Monday or Tuesday. Meanwhile, Israel is to start releasing nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Now, this will likely take many, many days. And on top of all this, Scott, Trump is expected to visit the region over the weekend. This would include a stop in Israel, where he's been invited to speak to the Israeli parliament, and possibly Egypt, where the negotiations for the ceasefire took place. So a very busy few days coming up.
But Greg, we have had ceasefires in this war before and they broke down pretty quickly. So why is this one different so far?
Well, Trump put a lot more pressure on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, more than he did when there was a ceasefire in January that collapsed, much more than President Biden did during his final year in office. Trump got Netanyahu to agree publicly to this deal, and then they put the pressure on Hamas. There was a lot of international support, particularly from Arab states like Egypt and Qatar, who work with Hamas. And the Israeli and Palestinian publics were just exhausted. They're strong majorities and on both sides who wanted this war to end. So lots of hard days ahead and plenty could go wrong, but there's a lot more momentum and a lot more leaders invested in making this work.
I want to go back to something you said a few moments ago, though. The war may be ending, but you mentioned Israeli troops will still be in Gaza. How long are they expected to stay?
Scott, there's no clear timeline. Israel has agreed to pull back in phases. It will initially move out of places like Gaza City and other Palestinian population centers. Now, they're eventually supposed to retreat to a buffer zone along the Gaza border, but still on the Gaza side of the border. Hamas had always demanded a full withdrawal of Israeli troops, but they just didn't have the leverage in these negotiations. With Israeli troops in Gaza, it wouldn't take much to restart hostilities. And just a final note, the ceasefire isn't yet formally in effect, and Israel did carry out a number of airstrikes today, saying its forces came under threat.
One big question that people have been asking for years, really, who would rule Gaza going forward?
Yeah, that is a huge question. Trump's plan, as outlined last week, says Hamas, which has ruled there for almost 20 years, is supposed to step aside, but they haven't publicly agreed to do that. It's the plan calls for Palestinian technocrats to take over, at least temporarily, but no one knows exactly who these people are, what authority they would have, how long they'd be there. And on top of this, there's supposed to be a committee, a Gaza committee, that Trump and the former British Prime Minister Tony Blair would head as a so-called board of peace, but they wouldn't be involved in the day-to-day running of Gaza, and it's not clear how they would address problems that might crop up.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie joining us from Tel Aviv. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Scott.
In the human body, cells are constantly making life or death decisions. If they make the wrong choice, the result can be cancer, infection, or even Alzheimer's. NPR's John Hamilton reports on efforts to treat diseases by influencing the process known as programmed cell death.
In Alzheimer's, brain cells die too soon. Cancer cells don't die soon enough. That's because both diseases alter the way cells decide when to end their lives. Doug Green of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis has spent much of his career studying this process.
Cell death sounds like sort of a morbid thing to work on, but in fact, it's really essential for our health.
Green says coaxing nerve cells to live longer could help people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, or ALS. Getting tumor cells to die sooner could help with other diseases.
If we can specifically modify or modulate the tendency of a cell to die, then, of course, we have the potential to treat a cancer.
So many scientists are looking to control programmed cell death. One of them is Randall Halfman at the Stowers Institute for Medical Research in Kansas City, Missouri. He's been studying immune cells that self-destruct when they come in contact with molecules that present a threat to the body.
They have to somehow recognize that in this vast array of other complex molecules and then within minutes kill themselves.
Like a soldier diving on a grenade. Halfman's team focused on special proteins inside cells that can initiate this process.
And what was surprising is that the proteins that are involved, when they recognize that virus, they implode.
Instantly crumpling and linking up with similarly affected proteins to form what's known as a death-fold polymer. That starts a chain reaction, creating more death-fold polymers, which ultimately kills the cell. This process takes a burst of energy, and Halfman's team couldn't locate the source. Then they thought about reusable hand warmers, which produce heat by changing from a liquid to a crystallized solid.
There's a little button inside, you can click it, and then it will crystallize right in front of you, and that releases all this energy. And that's exactly what we envisioned was happening for these proteins.
Halfman found it a bit unsettling to think that so many cells carry these self-destruct buttons just waiting to be pushed.
You know, it just seemed like a really terrible way to live, right? Every moment of a cell's life to be at risk of spontaneously dying.
Of course, death is what you want for a cancerous cell or one that's infected with a virus. But Halfman thinks this hair trigger system might be needlessly killing brain cells in diseases like Alzheimer's. He notes that one hallmark of Alzheimer's is a misfolded protein called amyloid.
That amyloid, right, for reasons we don't really understand, ends up killing the neurons, and in some cases it will go on and kill other neurons.
Perhaps because those misfolded amyloid proteins, much like death-fold proteins, seem to replicate and form crystal-like structures. So Halfman has begun looking for ways to keep brain cells alive by making it harder for those crystals to form. Doug Green, the researcher in Memphis, says biotech firms are trying to halt the process at a different point, by blocking the communication pathways involved in cell death.
One of these pathways is a major target for for many pharmaceutical companies that are working furiously to come up with a way to block that particular death-fold interaction.
Green says the companies are betting on products known as antisense drugs, which can prevent a cell from making key proteins involved in Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases.
If they're right, I think they are, it's going to cure a lot of diseases, diseases that we associate with aging and inflammation.
In part by changing how cells make life or death decisions. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Public broadcasting helped make artist Bob Ross a household name. Now the late painter's company wants to give back. It is auctioning off dozens of his original works, many of them painted live on a show, to support public TV after federal funding cuts. NPR's Rachel Treisman reports.
Bob Ross brought his soothing voice, sunny outlook, and trademark afro to over 400 episodes of The Joy of Painting, which aired on PBS between 1983 and his death in 1995.
We don't make mistakes, you know. We have happy accidents.
Decades later, viewers are streaming it online and still watching it on public TV. It's a medium that Ross cherished, says Joan Kowalski, the president of Bob Ross, Inc.
He used to talk about that a lot. He felt like he was in someone's living room, and it was just that one person.
At the direction of President Trump, Congress voted in July to claw back over $1 billion for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, slashing funding for PBS and NPR stations across the country. The next month, the auction house Bonhams sold two Bob Ross paintings for over $200,000 combined, exceeding their estimated value to set a new record.
And it just got me to thinking, you know, that's a substantial amount of money. And what if?
Kowalski, along with Bonhams and American Public Television, came up with a plan. They will auction off 30 of Ross's original paintings, with all net proceeds going to APT and PBS stations nationwide. They hope the money raised will help stations pay the licensing fees to air popular programs like America's Test Kitchen, Rick Steves Europe, and The Best of the Joy of Painting. Kowalski says if Ross were alive today,
I think this would have probably been his idea.
It's rare for Ross's paintings to make it out of storage and onto the market. He painted most of these 30 works on TV, while some are from his instructional books. They won't all be sold at once. The first three paintings are going up for auction in Los Angeles in November. Here's Robin Starr, the general manager of the auction house's Massachusetts branch.
Throughout the next year or so, we will be metering out the other 27 works, and those will be coming up out of our California, New York, and Massachusetts galleries.
Many are Ross's trademark landscapes, with vibrant mountains, lake views, lush forests, and his signature happy little trees. Here he is working on Home in the Valley, a 1993 painting that will be up for auction in November.
It's very simple, and it will teach you how to use all the equipment, and it's a lot of fun.
The auction house estimates the paintings could bring in up to $1.4 million, but organizers are hoping they will once again exceed expectations. As Starr said, happy trees, happy bidding.
And with the old signature on here, I think we're going to call that one finished.
Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at three shows this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, October 9th through the 11th, in Gilbert, Bemidji, and Grand Rapids, plus a festival all next week in Duluth. First up, award-winning blues guitarist P.K. Mayo is playing the Ore House in Gilbert Thursday at 6 p.m. Born in Eveleth, the Iron Reins musician is a member of the Minnesota Blues Hall of Fame and has released albums under P.K. Mayo and his full name, Paul Mayasich. His live repertoire includes his original tunes and a wide variety of folk, blues, rock, and country tunes. P.K. Mayo at the Ore House this Thursday. On Friday, Christopher David Hansen is playing solo at Bridget's Irish Pub in Bemidji at 7:30. A roots rock and Americana singer-songwriter, Hansen's most recent album was Whippoorwill in 2022, and he recently formed a new group called Bewilderness with his son Cameron on drums. It's Christopher David Hansen this Friday at Bridget's in Bemidji. On to Saturday,
Tattletale, Forge North, and Mary and Emily LaPlante are playing a benefit show at Rapids Brewing in Grand Rapids at 6 p.m. Headliners and host Tattletale are a psychedelic jazz fusion group who draw from Ethiopian jazz and other global funk sounds. Forge North are an Americana and jam band from Longville led by soulful songwriter Charlie Wagner. And Mary and Emily LaPlante are a talented mother-daughter bluegrass and folk duo. This Saturday in Grand Rapids at Rapids Brewing. And finally, a quick shout out to Wusso's 1 Week Live, taking place all next week, the 13th through the 18th in Duluth. Multiple bands perform each night, and the recordings will later be released as an album. The long-running series is one of the best documents of northeastern Minnesota music for over 20 years now. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Comes from this station. And from Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools, to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. All right, if you've been inside a supermarket lately, you know that groceries are getting pretty expensive, right? Prices keep going up. Grocery shopping has become an exercise in bargain hunting, buying store brands, using coupons, cutting back on spending for meat, seafood, eggs, even coffee. Yes, coffee. But there is one item that shoppers across the country are apparently hooked on, and that is butter. And not just any butter. We're talking about premium butter. Christina Peterson covers the food industry for Bloomberg, and she joins us now to talk about the luxury butter market. Welcome, Christina.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. I mean, I am a huge butter addict, but I need you to explain this nationwide. Like, Americans are already cutting back on most of their spending. Even though they are doing that, butter, of all things, seems to be defying that trend. Can you just explain, why is this happening?
I think there are really a couple of reasons here. One goes back to the pandemic, when everyone just did more cooking at home. Mm-hmm. And little luxuries that could elevate that and make it feel a little bit more special became popular. And butter was a big one of those. People were also baking more bread. Yes. And so having something a little bit fancy to go on that wouldn't break the bank, but was maybe a little bit more expensive than usual, kind of came in vogue.
But affordable, an affordable indulgence, if you will.
Exactly. And now I think people see it as something that just gives them a little bit of joy at a time when they are pulling back elsewhere. You know, if you spend $10 on butter, that is more than most people would normally do. But it's not the same as buying a super expensive bottle of wine, for example.
Sure, absolutely. Okay. It's like, okay, I'm being a little naughty here, but you know what? I need a little something to make my day a little better.
Yeah, and it lasts a while. You know, you don't consume a pound of butter in a sitting, hopefully.
Exactly. Well, sometimes with me, I can get close. Okay, so for people who are not aware of this trend, what are we even talking about when we are talking about premium butter?
Yeah, it comes in several different forms. So sometimes it's grass-fed. But one of the increasingly popular versions of premium butter is actually this European-style butter that has a higher percentage of butterfat. In Europe, butter has to be at least 82% butterfat. In the U.S., it's at least 80%. Mm-hmm. But companies that make butter started making these higher butterfat butters for chefs, and they were really popular. And so word got out, and people started asking for them at a retail level. And now more and more U.S. butter makers are now making these products that are creamier, a little bit fattier, and sometimes have flakes of sea salt in them.
Oh, yummy, yummy, yummy. Okay, wait. So just give people an idea. When we're talking about this fattier, creamier butter, sometimes with flakes of sea salt, What are some of the prices out there? Give people an idea.
If you're talking about French or Irish butters, they are more expensive than your standard supermarket butters.
Sure.
So you might be paying $10 for half a pound or more. But there are also some artisanal butters in the U.S. that are really expensive. There is a $60 a pound butter from a place called Animal Farm Creamery.
Oh my God.
And that's really due to the fact that they have a very small herd of cows, and therefore there's a much smaller supply of this prized milk that's going into this butter. So it's
okay,
really
hold
about,
on. Who is buying $60 a pound butter?
I think for these people, the challenge of actually getting this butter is part of the fun. I spoke with one gentleman who it took him three times to successfully purchase the butter because it sold out so fast. And the third time, he was so intent on getting his order through that he was boarding a plane and he held up traffic to make sure that he indeed got the butter.
I mean, I was going to ask you, have you tasted this $60 butter? Is it truly better?
I regret to inform you, I have not tasted the $60 butter. I did taste the $10 butter. It was delicious.
Well, what do you think all of this says to you about our food habits, maybe even our emotions as we're grocery shopping?
I think it does indicate that there's some bigger eating changes afoot. You know, there's been a real shift away from the low-fat diet. Mm. And there's also been a swing away from ultra-processed food. In the 70s, margarine was really popular.
Totally. I grew up on margarine.
Yeah. Now consumers are looking for something with a, quote, clean label, and butter is just cream and salt. So it's really a short ingredient list. It feels like an uncomplicated, unprocessed food to people. So I think those are all elements of it. And also, you know, butter makes things taste good.
Oh, it totally does. That is Bloomberg reporter Christina Peterson speaking to us about her story on premium butters. Thank you so much, Christina.
Thank you. Thank you for your enthusiasm about butter.
Who wouldn't be enthusiastic about butter? Oh, my God.
It is fall. It's pumpkin season. It's in your latte, in your beer, your David S. pumpkins, your front porch. But did you know the word pumpkin used to be an insult? NPR's Bill Chappell looks at pumpkin's history in this installment of Word of the Week.
We Americans love our nostalgia for simpler times. And pumpkins hit a sweet spot by evoking life in the countryside. Cindy Ott wrote a book about it called Pumpkin, The Curious History of an American Icon.
People are buying these things, even pumpkin spice latte, because of these attachments, these very old-fashioned ideas about reverence of the small family farm.
Even the word pumpkin refers more to an idea than a plant.
Pumpkin itself isn't exactly a botanical group.
That's Logan Kistler, curator of archaeobotany at the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History.
It's more describing the shape of any kind of squash that people have bred to look like what we think of as pumpkins.
The word pumpkin has roots in the English word pompion, according to Fiona McPherson. She's an executive editor with the Oxford English Dictionary.
The first example that we have of pumpkin is from 1647, and it's apparently with reference to the poor diet of early settlers.
Pumpkins are part of the genus Cucurbita. Logan Kistler says that in pre-colonial times, indigenous people in the Americas domesticated early pumpkins. They even used gourds as fishnet floats.
So there's what we call pumpkin, what we recognize as pumpkins, originating all throughout the Americas, going back as far as about 10,000 years in Mexico.
But Fiona McPherson says that soon after English speakers started using the word pumpkin, it became an insult.
1680, we see an example of it being used, applied contemptuously to a person who's a bit conceited or self-important or stupid.
By the late 19th century, pumpkin got a glow-up. It became a term of endearment for kids. And as cities grew, so did Americans' nostalgia for rural life. Here's Cindy Ott.
They like to imagine themselves farmers at heart, many of them, and a pumpkin has been a way to maintain those connections. So that's when the pumpkin became the pumpkin. It's a cultural history and not a botanical one.
Today, the story has a twist. Descendants of the same pumpkins that once sustained indigenous civilizations and early settlers are now supporting small farmers. Think of your local pumpkin patch.
But it's actually helping to rejuvenate the small family farm. Without the pumpkin, most small-scale farmers would have to do something else.
You might even call it a rescue by the great pumpkin. Bill Chappell, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. on Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Now it's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. A wildfire that started Wednesday has grown to 50 acres in George H. Crosby Manitou Park near Tofte in Lake County. The Minnesota Interagency Fire Center reports the fire is burning in mixed maple hardwoods and fall leaf litter, primarily in a remote ridge area of the park. Steep terrain is making access to the fire area more difficult for firefighters, but the fire didn't change much overnight. Crews were working on establishing a containment line around the fire's perimeter Thursday. The state park and the Superior Hiking Trail remain open to public use, but due to the increase in firefighting activity, officials are advising visitors to use caution. The criminal vehicular homicide case against Cynthia Cindy Martin will move forward after the judge denied motions to suppress evidence and dismiss the case. Chelsea Perkins gives us the details.
65-year-old Martin of rural Grand Rapids is accused of hitting and killing 19-year-old Carter Hathcock with her SUV. She then drove away from the site on Highway 169 near Nashwalk the night of July 3rd, 2024. In a Wednesday order, Judge Heidi Chandler ruled there is sufficient probable cause for the trial to proceed. Chandler further ruled that evidence gathered as part of a driving while intoxicated investigation will remain in the case record. On the date of the incident, law enforcement responded to a report of a person lying in the middle of the road. Hathcock was pronounced dead at the scene. Martin called to report her possible involvement in the incident early the next morning. She allegedly told law enforcement that she thought she hit an owl or a turkey when they arrived at her home to investigate. After she said she'd consumed 5 milligrams of prescribed hydrocodone over the course of the day of the crash, a DWI investigation occurred. Months later, the results of Martin's blood test were negative for all the substances for which it was tested. DWI is not a charge she faces in the case. The incident and prosecution of the case have been under public scrutiny because of Martin's political leadership positions. Martin is the chair of the 8th Congressional District DFL Party and vice chair of the Itasca County DFL Party, according to the organization's websites. A plea hearing is scheduled for November 5th in Itasca County District Court. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
The Minnesota Department of Human Rights has secured two settlements of what it calls blatant workplace sex discrimination from northern Minnesota employers. Lakes Concrete Plus in Bemidji reached a $45,000 settlement over its unlawful firing of a concrete truck driver. According to an investigation, the truck driver was fired on account of her sex, with Lakes Concrete reportedly telling her that driving a concrete truck was not, quote, woman's work, and that she should find a job, quote, more fitting. Key Lime Air in Thief River Falls also reached a $45,000 settlement with a qualified applicant they refused to hire on account of his sex. The department found that Key Lime Air has a practice of only hiring women as flight attendants because it believes women are, quote, better than men for the position. Minnesota's civil rights law requires employers to prevent and address sex discrimination with job applicants and employees. The Federal Small Business Administration has opened a disaster loan outreach center at Bemidji's Fire Station No. 2. The agency is offering low-interest disaster loans for businesses, private nonprofits, and residents affected by the June 21st severe storms. The center will be closed on Monday in observance of Indigenous Peoples/Columbus Day, but is otherwise open during the federal government shutdown. Hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturdays. Businesses and nonprofits can apply for business physical disaster loans and borrow up to $2 million to repair or replace disaster-damaged or destroyed assets. Homeowners and renters are eligible to apply for home and personal loans up to $100,000 to replace or repair personal property. Homeowners can also apply for up to $500,000 to replace or repair their primary residence. Find more information at KAXE.org. That's it for the Up North Report. Find more of our stories and photos at KAXE.org, where you can also find content from our music, phonology, and morning show teams. Sign up for the Buzz newsletter for the week's best stories and audio from your favorite community radio station. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. High-stakes legal arguments over President Trump's efforts to deploy the National Guard in Portland and in Chicago played out at the same time in two federal courthouses today. Both cases have major implications for questions over presidential authority and the use of federal troops on American soil. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz has been following all of this and joins us now. Hi, Jacqueline.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. Okay, so explain what these hearings were about exactly. Like, what were the arguments on the different sides?
Yeah, of course. So they're both very similar. In Chicago, a federal judge heard arguments over imposing a ban on the deployment of National Guard troops from the state, along with soldiers all the way from Texas. Mm-hmm. And for the case out of Portland, three judges on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals heard arguments over whether to end a similar ban imposed by a federal judge over the weekend.
Okay, and it can be kind of confusing to understand exactly where these troops are, if they're even deployed yet or not. Can you just break all of that down for us, at least as of now?
Right. So in Chicago, a U.S. official who was not authorized to speak publicly told NPR that a couple dozen Texas National Guard soldiers are guarding an ICE facility outside the city as of this morning. Mm-hmm. But broadly, a few hundred Texas and Illinois National Guard troops have been federalized to respond to Chicago, which Trump claims is overrun by protests and violence, and he wants them to help with immigration enforcement. And local officials strongly disagree, by the way. But troops are not out in the streets of Chicago just yet. And in Portland, a couple hundred National Guard soldiers are kind of in this limbo. They've been federalized, but haven't been sent out into the streets because of this ongoing court battle blocking their deployment.
Right. Okay, so what were some key moments from today's hearings?
So in the Oregon case, DOJ prosecutor Eric MacArthur was representing the federal government, and he wrapped his arguments by saying that the Portland protesters were violent people and that there is a major risk of future violence if the government puts their guard down. And Oregon Assistant Attorney General Stacey Chaffin, who's arguing to block the deployment, says courts can give the president a lot of deference in his judgments, but she says,
that deference has a limit, and that limit is this case, where the president's determinations are untethered from reality.
And Chaffin said the judges should focus on whether the current situation in Portland can justify sending troops in, and that the judges should not consider events from earlier this summer. And that's when protesters forced an ICE facility in the city to shut down for a few weeks. But at least two of the judges just didn't seem to buy that argument.
Okay, so that's Portland. Tell us about Chicago.
And in Chicago today, there was a similar focus. Eric Hamilton, the attorney for the U.S. Justice Department, said the president's decision to send troops basically can't be challenged or reviewed. Chicago public media reporters were in that courtroom, and they reported on this interesting moment when U.S. District Judge April Perry acknowledged the seriousness of threats facing public servants like ICE agents and those National Guard troops. And she said she started getting threats about 10 minutes after getting assigned this case. And it's worth noting Judge Perry is planning to reconvene at 4:30 local time, so we might have an update in that case later today.
Well, can we talk about the larger implications here, Jacqueline? Like, how might today's proceedings impact these kinds of cases overall, you think?
Yeah, so at the center of these cases is this much bigger question, you know, just how far does presidential power really go? Are there limits? And University of Houston law professor Christopher Mirasola said this is not just about National Guard deployments. It's an issue that continues to come up in other legal cases, including some that have gone before the Supreme Court.
It's really at issue in the cases about sanctions, about presidential immunity. It's this larger trend that I think is coming to typify the current Supreme Court.
Okay, so what can we expect next?
Now we're kind of waiting. Legal scholars like Mirasola said these judges will likely take their time to consider the arguments, but he thinks maybe we can see something in the next 24 to 48 hours, maybe. But it's important in the long run that regardless of the outcome of these cases, either side will probably appeal.
Okay, that is NPR's Jacqueline Diaz. Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
Time now for Here to Help, our series on volunteerism in America. This week, a visit to the Tech Fairy. Craig Clark has refurbished hundreds of computers and devices at his home outside Sarasota, Florida. And he's got the photos to prove it.
In the 700 pictures, there's a lot of convenience stores workers, there's a lot of fast food workers, people that I know are working for minimum wage and probably cannot afford a $1,200 laptop.
Clark worked in management for a chain of convenience stores for 26 years. When he retired, he became a computer technician. And that is when he got the idea to provide laptops for people who could not afford them.
People would give me their old computers when they bought a new one, and I would fix them up and find someone to give them to.
Since he started 8 years ago, Craig Clark says his success in handing out hundreds of functioning computers is in part the name.
I have no memory as to why or how I branded myself as a tech fairy, but I am convinced that none of the good things that have happened, and if I hadn't done that.
The other part of his success?
I couldn't do it without the generous donations that I get, and I probably have 7 in the house now. I've got to fix up. So there's a lot of people that are sitting with laptops in their closet. I picked up 2 yesterday.
Clark is a one-man operation, changing out computer parts that don't work at no cost to the recipients.
I give away about 8 or 9 a month, and it costs me probably, well, I put a new hard drive in every laptop, and that's like $35 or $40 each. That's $20,000 there.
Clark says that while the cost for his Tech Fairy operation continues to grow, the value to recipients can be life-changing. Here's one example. A server at Clark's favorite restaurant accepted one of those refurbished laptops.
He came up and said, Craig, I just want you to know, last week I got 2 $6,000 grants from my college that I never would have even known about if I didn't have that laptop.
Now, Clark doesn't just hand out laptops to familiar faces. When he's out shopping at places like secondhand stores, he just walks up to people who might be checking out a used laptop but stop short of buying it. He's even worked up a bit of a script for those situations.
I will say something like, I noticed you were looking at a computer, but you didn't pick it up. He said, well, I can't afford it. Well, let me talk to you about that. And then I would open up my iPad and I'd show them the people I've given computers to, and then they're convinced I'm for real.
Clark is happy to keep granting wishes one rehab laptop at a time.
I never had a plan. It was just something that happened and kind of blew out from underneath me. But I'm so pleased it did, and I'm so delighted. I love fixing computers and watching people smile. So it's been really good for me.
That's Craig Clark, the real-life tech fairy of Sarasota, Florida. You can find more stories of volunteerism in America at npr.org/here to help.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
Scientists are learning more about a unique group of dinosaurs with domed heads. They're mysterious creatures because their fossil records are so incomplete. But a stunning discovery from southern Mongolia has changed that.
I mean, everyone just stood around the lab just holding this precious, incredible skull. Everyone is enchanted. It's just the most beautiful specimen.
Hear more tomorrow on your NPR member station or listen on the NPR One app. You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wild card deck to answer a big life question. Brené Brown says to be courageous, you first need to be vulnerable. In her new book, Strong Ground, she explores leadership in our rapidly changing world with a popular quote that she uses for guidance.
The quote is that between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is the power of choice. And in that choice is our growth and our freedom. And I understand right now that stimulus and response are just smashed together. But it's the job right now, I think, of great leaders, I think in our families, in our own lives, to create a space between stimulus and response.
Brené Brown talked with the host of Wildcard, Rachel Martin.
What's a moment with a stranger that made you feel loved?
I am pretty sure that I have escaped death every time I fly. I'm pretty sure it's not, we're not supposed to be doing that. And I continue to get on planes because I have to for my work. Mm-hmm. But I do believe it's death-defying every time. Mm-hmm. And so over the past 20 years, no matter who's sitting next to me, if the turbulence gets bad, mm-hmm. I will play the same game. I'm like, hey, I'm scared, and I was wondering if I could just talk to you for a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And they're usually like, sure. And then I say, what's your favorite type of food? Mm-hmm. You know, and they'll say Italian. I'll say, what's your favorite Italian? What's your favorite dessert? And I kind of just engage with them that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it makes me feel loved, but it makes me believe in love. Because I think if you put the person who I hate today the most, which will be someone around politics probably, in a seat next to me and we're going down, we're probably going to hold hands and pray. Mm-hmm. One of my big things is to try to find the face of God in everyone. Mm-hmm. And mostly I see people and I want to punch them in the throat. And so it makes it really hard because you don't want to ever punch God in the throat. I mean, like, right. Like I can be irreverent, but no. I think it's just a weird reminder that in some really deep way we belong to each other.
Mm-hmm. Are people mostly receptive when you're having one of those moments and you're like, I need to talk to you right now? Like, are they doing it reluctantly or are they, they're like, I get it. Are they generous with you?
One time, one guy was kind of an and it was helpful because in that moment I was like, Lord, deliver me from this earth and these people. he still helped. He just wasn't a willing participant. I was just like, yeah, okay. I
this is my time.
This is, take me to the promised land.
Watch the full chat with Brené Brown by searching for Wild Card with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Brené Brown's Strong Ground is out now.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com.
This is NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. The Arrowhead Library System presents They Brought Their Songs, International Folk Music in Minnesota, with musical trio Kay Lee, now through November 5th. Find a full list of dates, times, and locations at als.info. We receive support from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. National Fire Prevention Week is now through October 11th, and the Minnesota DNR offers guidelines for wildfire prevention. Keep campfires small and manageable, and always have plenty of water nearby. Hold off on burning large debris piles until there is 3 inches of snow cover. Always check if a burning permit is needed. If you see a wildfire, move to a safe location and call 911. We need you to defend KAXE with your donations. Due to funding losses, these are uncertain times for our little station. There are many ways to preserve people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Visit kaxe.org/give or call Heather at 218-326-1234. Fire in the Village hosts the Creative Crow Club the first Wednesday of each month from 4 to 6 at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. Youth can explore their artistic gifts, find their voice, and build a caring community. United Way Bemidji will distribute coats for the community Saturday, October 11th from 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of winter items is welcome. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Since she was a little girl, Jennifer Lopez has always wanted to star in a musical because musicals could transport her anywhere.
Just like imagining all different kinds of beautiful places and a different world than your own reality.
Now, decades into her career, her dream has come true. Lopez stars in the new film, Kiss of the Spider-Woman.
Soon or late, you're certain to meet. In the bedroom, the parlor, or even the street, there's no...
It feels like you've escaped into a magical little world where people express themselves through music and dance. I mean, and what, as an artist who is a singer and who is a dancer and who is an actor, what more could you ask for?
Lopez plays La Luna, a golden age movie star whose picture hangs on a prison wall of two cellmates. They were jailed during Argentina's military dictatorship in the early 1980s. And as they're gazing at La Luna's portrait, one reenacts her greatest film to the other in this story about courage and love, which is where Jennifer Lopez and I began our conversation.
It's not your typical musical. It is a love story. It is more of a drama that has all these musical numbers that they escape into.
Yeah.
And it is, at the heart, a love story between these two people who are from very different, you know, backgrounds, different political views, different ends of the gender spectrum. One cis man, one queer and trans character, actually. And how two people who are so different can kind of get past all of those labels and really see the humanity in another person. So if you're asking me like what the message of the movie is, I think the message is if you just allow yourself to see the humanity in people that you could fall in love with them, no matter how different from you, you think they are.
Yeah. You have been an entertainer for so many years. What did it feel like to finally star in your first musical after wanting to do a musical for years and years?
I know. It's wild because you have a long career, if you're lucky enough. But these roles like this for me and for people like me don't come around every day. You know, the last time I had a big role like this filled with music and just an epic story was Selena.
Yes.
And exactly. I've done a lot of beautiful movies in the meantime.
And just so people understand how challenging this movie was filmed in just a matter of weeks, right? So all the musical numbers had to be shot in single takes. How hard was that?
I think even if we would have had more time, Bill Condon, the director, was very, very adamant that we shoot this musical in the style of a 50s musical. And what they would do is they would create these long shots. So he was like, one of the reasons that I wanted you so badly for this role was because I know you can perform a number from beginning to end. Like you could do it from top to bottom perfect.
It was exquisite.
Oh, thank you.
Did this whole experience in any way change your own understanding of what you are capable of?
Here's the thing. I wanted to do it so badly. Like, there was nothing that was going to keep me. It's like Tonatiuh, who plays Molina, yes, the lead in the movie, said, when you get a role like this, it's like you can leave no crumbs on the floor. Like, you have to dig so deep into it. So I guess it showed me we could do it quickly, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, and that you don't have to have all the time to make something a really great piece of art. But it would have been nice to have a little more time.
Well, I want to talk about how you breathed life into what could have been a two-dimensional character, right? Like, mm-hmm, La Luna starts in this movie as just some face on a poster on the wall, right, of a prison cell, this two-dimensional idea of a movie star. And it's, right, your performance that brings her to three-dimensional form. And I, right, couldn't help but connect that two-dimensional idea of the movie star of La Luna to you and perceptions people may have of who J-Lo is, right? Like, mm-hmm, there was this larger, mm-hmm, parallel for me when I was watching.
Right.
Do you sometimes feel that the public tries to flatten you, like confine you to some two-dimensional image of what they think you are or should be?
You know, it's funny. I hear two different questions. Mm-hmm. I don't feel, as an actor in the business, that they've been able to kind of do that to me. I think the thing that has kind of always set me apart is that I really held on to, I'm Jennifer Lopez, a Puerto Rican girl from the Bronx. That's who I am. And I think I didn't have to lose that to star in romantic comedies. Mm-hmm. But I think another part to that question is, do people kind of make you into something or someone that's not real?
Or pressure you to pick a lane and be just a certain aspect of who Jennifer Lopez is? You know?
Yeah, I have to say, I don't feel that. I feel more that people put on you what they think you might be like. Mm-hmm. I feel like, mm-hmm, I've always been so consistent as a person that obviously people get who I am, and I think they do. But there's always this, like, little bit of, like, noise that's going on, that's negativity in the world.
And does that noise, does it affect the work that you pick to do next? Like, how much the public,
no,
defines you? Are you ever saying, no, to yourself, oh, yeah, you think that's what I am? Well, I want to defy your expectation.
No,
I want,
no,
you to,
no,
learn this is also who I,
no,
am.
No, when you start doing that, I think you're in huge trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, honestly, I think the thing that has saved me is that I've been able to keep my feet on the ground and I know who I am. And I've been able to evolve and grow that part of myself. So I've become more and more solid in who I am as a woman and as a person. I've found that that has become very unshakable. And so I don't concentrate on, like, what do I have to prove to anybody anymore? What I do is I go, what project excites me that I feel that I could put more love and goodness and happiness and joy into the world?
So when you think about who you are, do you ever think about the story you want people to tell about you and, huh, your career? Like, if it were your face on a poster, on a wall, in a musical,
yeah,
not La Luna's, yours, and people,
right,
started dancing and singing about you, what is the story that they would tell about you and the art and the love you gave to the world?
Yeah, I think what I would want is for them to say, you know, she was resilient, she was a hard worker, she was kind, she made me laugh, she made me cry, she made me dance, she made me sing, she made me jump up and down. And, you know, most importantly, she was a good mom.
Mm, yeah.
You know, things,
yeah,
like that. Those are the things that I think if somebody's talking about me after I'm gone, like, she was a good mom and she was a showgirl. She was an entertainer and she loved what she did and she was passionate about it. And she was a good exemplary person who I would want my daughters to look up to.
Well, I love watching you tell your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jennifer Lopez stars in the new movie Kiss of the Spider-Woman. It is
in theaters
now.
Yes. Yes. Please go to the theater. It is visually stunning and you will enjoy it, I promise.
Thank you so much, Jennifer, for this conversation. I so enjoyed talking to you.
I appreciate you. Thank you so much.
I cannot tell you how you'll meet him.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Odoo, maker of all-in-one management software with the goal of being simple to use for all employees. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. Weather tonight, cloudy with lows in the mid to upper 40s, gusty winds up to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow, sunny with highs 58 to 62, breezy northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm